this week on COVID Brace and Democracy.
There was no time. There was no time to leave. There was nowhere to go. They didn't have time. They didn't have the means to escape. And, you know, when the storm is bearing down on you in 6 hours, many people were pretty much forced to stay.
People flee their homes as Hurricane Ian hits Florida.
It's outrageous that Rashida Tlaib is getting attacked. Tlaib is merely stating that Israel is an apartheid state and that people who claim to have progressive values cannot support an apartheid state. No matter how loose a definition of progressive we use, it certainly excludes supporting a racist apartheid system.
Journalist Katie Halper was fired by The Hill after defending Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib for calling Israel an apartheid state.
We need United Airlines to fix the operational issues that they have not only with our customers, but also internally. Our scheduling, we have to wait 4, 5, 6 hours sometimes to find out where we might be sleeping tonight.
And striking food service workers and United Airlines flight attendants protest union busting at San Francisco International Airport. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt of KPFT Houston. This week, Florida suffered an environmental and social catastrophic event when Hurricane Ian hit the state, causing massive floods, displacement, and death. Jack Wallace, host of WSLR Radio St. Petersburg, The Ruthless Truth, was on the ground speaking to survivors. He shared his insights with Pacifica's Steve Zelter.
Hey, this is Steve Zelter with Pacifica, and we're speaking today with Jack Wallace. He's with WSLR in St. Petersburg, Florida, with the program Ruthless Truth. Welcome to COVID, Race, and Democracy, Jack.
Thank you very much for having me.
This has been a historic storm, and in a state in which, subject to the hurricanes like Puerto Rico, like Cuba, was the state prepared for what happened in this hurricane?
Yeah, certainly not. I was just out today doing some just sort of interviewing people and giving out relief. And that was one of the things that, you know, we were talking the most with people was like, hey, did you feel like you were prepared by either the state or your county officials? And the overwhelming answer that people were giving back to us, right, was no, like, no, no, no. Actually, in Lee County, the county where where Fort Myers is and where the brunt of the sort of the damage happened, right? People didn't get sort of mandatory evacuation orders until Tuesday, like midday. And the storm was hitting Tuesday night. So for many folks who were, you know, hadn't even gotten off of work yet, there was no time. There was no time to leave. There was nowhere to go. They didn't have time. They didn't have the means to escape. And, you know, when the storm is bearing down on you in 6 hours, many people were pretty much forced to stay. And I think that's just really important that, we sort of push back on the narrative that I've been seeing a lot in the media, which is around that sort of, oh, like Floridians are stupid, right? Or Floridians are, you know, sort of used to these storms. And so they're not worried about it. It's like, no, well, most people are worried about it, but they may not necessarily have either the time or the means to be able to make it out.
And you have a governor, Ron DeSantis, who's a denialist, along with others, Trump, that there is climate change. What is his position? Is that the reason there's no real preparation for this kind of terrible disaster?
I mean, I think it's just sort of an American thing almost, right? You know, I don't feel like there's many places in the country where, you know, we are properly prepared for something like this. We have basically a all for one, one for all sort of culture and system that we have, sort of our economic system. And, you know, that comes through the policy. And so, you know, how the evacuations are done is that, you know, it's up to you. It's your responsibility to evacuate. And, you know, that completely leaves out the context that most people live paycheck to paycheck. They can't afford to go out and, you know, pay for a hotel room, right? And in a different state, they don't have the time to be able to gather up their kids, their pets, all that sort of thing. And so certainly Ron DeSantis does not help, right? You know, he's not even trying to pretend like he was ready to help Floridians. I believe he just started talking about basically a GoFundMe for the entire state to help fund the relief efforts. And, you know, it's like we know these storms happen every single year, right? You know, maybe there should be millions or billions of dollars in the state budget that's set aside for, you know, hurricane relief and evacuation. You know, that's really what should be happening. And it should, you know, it should be an organized system. It should be, you know, sort of one that's like tested often, right? This should be like clockwork, right? This should be something, you know, we're not strangers to storms here in Florida. You know, we continue to get this wrong because we, you know, I'll say we, but the politicians and those that be, you know, find it to either be unprofitable to sort of try to get people out, or, you know, just for lots of other reasons as well.
And of course, they don't believe in taxation, taxing the rich. They've encouraged corporations to go to Florida, that they're not going to have to pay taxes, really. And now this disaster has been horrific for working people, right? The population of Florida. Why don't we talk about the effect of this? How big a part of Florida has been affected by this hurricane in a serious way?
Yeah, I would say probably most of the biggest population centers here in Florida have been affected, right? So the Tampa Bay area, of course, which has Tampa and St. Petersburg, were affected. Of course, Fort Myers and sort of the Cape Coral area, that was where it was most affected. Miami got strong winds and rains, and, you know, there was some flooding down in South Florida. It was not as strong of a hurricane by the time it got to Orlando, but the center of the storm passed over Orlando, and there was some pretty bad flooding there as well. So, you know, that's basically what maybe five of the largest population centers in the state were basically affected by this storm. And, you know, if you looked at the satellite imagery of just sort of the cloud coverage from Hurricane Ian, you know, it's practically the entire state was covered, you know, basically on Wednesday or Tuesday night. You know, so this has been called like one of the worst disasters, natural disasters, and, you know, certainly Floridian history, right? And I would have to agree with them. We're going to need historic investments in rebuilding and, you know, rebuilding people's lives. And it's going to take billions of dollars. It's just the truth.
And many of the areas that we're talking about in Florida are at the water edge. In fact, Florida touts itself, you're able to go on the beach. Are these sustainable with the growing increase of hurricanes and the rising water levels, not only in Florida, but throughout the world?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually something that we were talking about a lot with people, you know, on the ground who are affected today, right? Especially this Southwest Florida area. A lot of it used to be mangroves. It used to be it has barrier islands, right? These were sort of natural protections from these sorts of storms that were able to absorb water and sort of absorb these winds and these rains and sort of, you know, sort of recycle it naturally back into the atmosphere, obviously back into the ecosystem. And, you know, what these developers, you know, who have come in, you know, looking for massive profits and have made massive profits, right? Use like dredging and filling, which is basically taking out land from beneath the waves and sort of bringing it up on top and sort of making a bunch of small canals. And, you know, in these different communities, it's basically so that everybody can have waterfront property. And so we've taken away the natural protections in the mangroves and sort of the barrier islands. And then we've made it even more dangerous by making sure that everybody has a little canal in their backyard or their front yard. And, you know, these developers came in and made massive profits here in the 20th century, building all these places. And, you know, it continues to this day. And, you know, it's irresponsible. It puts people in danger. All that, so that, you know, some wealthy real estate developers can make a couple more extra bucks.
And many of those affected now, most dramatically, are working class people, people in trailers. How are these people being affected from what your investigation was of going to the areas?
We asked people, right, like, how do you think you're going to be able to recover, right? How do you think you're going to be able to, you know, be able to rebuild your life? And, you know, most people said they either like couldn't get through to FEMA, either because they don't have power, so they can't fill out an application or send a call because they don't have any cellular service, or that, you know, they already applied to FEMA and they haven't heard back yet. People are desperate, and they know that they're going to have to scrounge together what they can to be able to try to recover from this. One of the other biggest problems, right, is flood insurance here in the state of Florida. Flood insurance companies have basically been fleeing from the state because they don't want to insure people who are too high a risk, who of course need it the most, right? Like a lot of these mobile homes, like if it's built before a certain year, you cannot get flood insurance on it, even though these are the most vulnerable, vulnerable sort of housing locations for flooding. There needs to be some sort of change in system where, you know, we can guarantee people these homes, and, you know, so that they can, you know, housing, you know, in my view, should be a human right. People should be able to live without the fear that if a hurricane comes, they won't be able to rebuild their homes again, right? They should be guaranteed that either by the federal or the state government. But, you know, it's really hard to see people and talking to them and basically being like, where is the money going to come from to help you fix your home? And they said, well, we don't have flood insurance. They wouldn't sell it to us, or it was too expensive. And, you know, we'll see what FEMA pays out. You know, people are not expecting a lot, and, you know, they're desperate, and they're going to have to rely on their friends and their families. And, you know, these are climate refugees. At the end of the day, these are climate refugees, these people who are going to be made homeless. They're going to have to move to other parts of the state. They're going to have to move back in with their parents, wherever that may be in the United States. And so we're going to have an influx of climate refugees coming from Fort Myers, you know. And I think that goes to your point about earlier, about sort of Ron DeSantis and President Trump, who sort of don't believe in this climate change stuff. It's like, well, like, here's the living, breathing proof. We have climate refugees in Florida right now who need places to stay.
And we're speaking with Jack Wallace. He is a reporter who's been covering this, and many people have been escaping from Puerto Rico and other places precisely to get away from the hurricanes. Is that the case in Florida?
Yeah, there's actually a very large Puerto Rican population in Orlando, of course, as well as Miami. You know, these are the places where folks are able to come across, you know, from Puerto Rico to the States. You know, they're looking for some sort of economic stability. They're looking for some sort of, you know, hope for a better future, just because of the way that the U.S. sort of manages its neo-colony in Puerto Rico. You know, they've saddled it with debt, and they've, you know, basically sort of crashed the electrical system, privatized it, and sort of sold it out to the highest bidder. Their electrical system there in Puerto Rico. And, you know, it's really frustrating because, you know, there were so many climate refugees who came from Puerto Rico, right? Like you mentioned, you know, who came from Maria and sort of the infamous the shot of Trump, you know, sort of shooting the paper towels to, you know, sort of climate refugees from Puerto Rico. It's a haunting image. And, you know, it's just more condemnation of a system that values people over profit. We were talking with people today saying that, like, you know, like, hey, like, if the government, if we're supposed to be a government for the people and by the people, right, then the government should have some responsibility to protect us from things like this, right? You know, people in Northport and Fort Myers, like, they didn't do anything wrong. Like, you know, this is a natural disaster. And imagine if something like FEMA was basically privatized or anything like that for the meager help that they give. And, you know, for all the criticisms I have of FEMA, right, I certainly wouldn't want them to be privatized, because everything would just get worse. You know, it would, the supplies would, you know, probably go to the highest bidder, kind of like they do now. You know, they'd be going to the richer and the wider areas, kind of as they do now. And unfortunately, you know, this is something that we were talking about with folks, but, you know, we're going to have to agitate, especially the federal government, to say, hey, like, you need to get this aid out ASAP. It needs to come with no strings attached. And it needs to just be to replace people's homes and replace people's incomes, because, of course, the businesses that people work are going to be destroyed as well. And it's going to take massive federal investment. And certainly privatization is not going to help anything. And so, you know, all of these homes and these sort of high rises and condos and things like that, people are going to start to realize, like, hey, like, Florida is not taking care of its people. Like, the state of Florida is just not doing it. And you know, it's because like it's based off this for-profit system. It certainly is not profitable to protect the people. It's profitable to screw them over, to rip them off, to cut corners, and all the rest.
And the government, Biden and Pelosi, and the Republicans have just passed a budget that includes $13 billion to Ukraine. This massive investment in Ukraine, what do you think about in relationship to that and what is facing the people of Florida?
I mean, I reserve my highest condemnation for the people in power in the federal government. You know, they say there's never enough money for social programs here at home, you know, regardless of the party, right? And they say like, oh, where are we going to have the money for this? Where are we going to have the money for that? But when there's war, when there's death and destruction in other countries, you know, they're always ready to pony up the money. I'd say to President Biden and Speaker Pelosi is that hey, the people of Florida can use those billions of dollars. Like, send that down here. Like, you know, like we're in this is a national crisis. And, you know, it has to be recognized as such. The people of Florida need to be funded in the same way that, you know, we fund defense contractors and different mercenaries across the world. We need to fund the people, not war. But we have six sort of major demands. And we were getting out signatures for that today. You know, we're telling the government, right, like, don't let your neglect create another Katrina disaster. We need, you know, these things. The first one, release billions of dollars in FEMA aid for home and community rebuilding and for incomes with no strings attached and no paperwork obstacles for people to receive help. The second is sending emergency responders to all affected areas immediately to assist in the recovery efforts. You know, this is may seem sort of obvious, but, you know, as we can see with FEMA and other emergency responders, they don't always go into the Black neighborhoods. They don't always go into the poor neighborhoods first, right? We need all lives to be treated like they all matter the same. Number three, provide food and shelter for all people as long as a disaster lasts. Number four, transfer all people incarcerated in affected areas to safe out-of-state facilities. We saw this with the Lee County Jail in Fort Myers. That jail there is sort of in downtown Fort Myers, and it's in an evacuation zone A, but they didn't evacuate the prisoners who are held there and who, might I add, are also mostly in their, on bail, like sort of, not even convicted of anything yet, right? They're still awaiting their trial. Number five is money for Floridians' needs, not the Pentagon, not the war in Ukraine. And number six is we would like a full federal investment to tackle climate change, of course, which is increasing in frequency and the severity of hurricanes like Ian. And those are sort of our six main demands. And I think ones that, the federal and state governments could do with basically the flick of a wrist, right? With signing of a couple documents, and these would be very popular things for the people of Florida and Fort Myers. It's what we need. It's nothing less than we deserve.
That was Jack Wallace, host of WSLR Radio, St. Petersburg's The Ruthless Truth, speaking with Pacifica Steve Zelter about Hurricane Ian. Chumbawamba. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. UN World Food Program Chief David Beasley says that the world is facing drastic food shortages for several reasons, including a shortage of the nitrate fertilizers used to grow half the world's food crops. Pacifica's Ann Garrison has more.
China is the world's top producer of nitrate fertilizers. The U.S. and Russia are in second and third place. Which is second and which is third depends on the source. UN World Food Program Chief David Beasley says that Russia's inability to export fertilizer because of the Ukraine war is central to the fertilizer crisis.
We're looking at an $11 billion shortfall of food production inside Africa alone. Now, I could go to Central America, South America, same issues on droughts. India, devastated by heat and drought, and it could go on and on. The world produces enough food to feed everybody on the planet, over 7.7 billion people. 50% of that food is because of fertilizer. So if you don't have fertilizer, you can't have harvest the yields that you need. The fertilizers that we're talking about, number one, China's got a complete export ban on fertilizer. Number two, the number two producer of fertilizer in the world is Russia. And they are struggling to get the fertilizer out. I'm asking world leaders, I don't care how you feel about Russia, China, or anything, fertilizers have got to move to bring food security to the rest of the world. Otherwise, there's going to be chaos all over the world.
Much of the problem has been caused by the closure of a pipeline carrying ammonia from Russia to Ukraine's Black Sea coast. 80 to 90% of all manufactured ammonia is used as fertilizer or used to make other nitrate fertilizers. UN diplomats have been holding discussions with Kiev and Moscow to reopen Russia's ammonia pipeline. Environmentalists and organic agriculture advocates say that nitrogen fertilizers are bad for the environment and that their large-scale industrial manufacture creates the supply chain vulnerabilities seen now.
That was Pacificus and Garrison on the global food and fertilizer crises. Next week, we'll discuss both with Tufts University professor and agriculture policy expert Timothy A. Wise. Representative Rashida Tlaib got into hot water with the Democratic Party leadership for asserting that you can't be progressive and support Israel's apartheid government. Independent journalist Katie Halper says she submitted a commentary to the Hill TV's morning broadcast Rising, in which she presented facts to substantiate Tlaib's apartheid charge. The Hill censored the segment and then fired Halper. Here is some of what Harper recorded, but Rising refused to air.
Representative Rashida Tlaib has been condemned by some over comments she made about Israel. Here's CNN's Jake Tapper reporting on what the Michigan Democrat said and the response it prompted.
Democratic Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib of Michigan facing criticism today from what several of her Jewish colleagues have deemed anti-Semitic comments. Here's what Tlaib, the first Palestinian-American woman to serve in Congress, said at a virtual event yesterday.
I want you all to know that among progressives, it has become clear that you cannot claim to hold progressive values, yet back Israel's apartheid government. And we will continue to push back and not accept this idea that you are progressive, except for Palestine any longer.
The CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt, slammed the comments, saying that Israel does not have an apartheid government and said that she should not be imposing a, quote, litmus test in a tweet, saying, quote, Tlaib tells American Jews that they need to pass an anti-Zionist litmus test to participate in progressive space. Some of Tlaib's Jewish colleagues in Congress agreed. Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz called her comments, quote, outrageous and, quote, nothing short of anti-Semitic.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz is right. It is outrageous. It's outrageous that Rashida Tlaib is getting attacked. Tlaib is merely stating that Israel is an apartheid state and that people who claim to have progressive values cannot support an apartheid state. No matter how loose a definition of progressive we use, it certainly excludes supporting a racist apartheid system. What's outrageous is attacking Tlaib for pointing out that progressive except for Palestine is an intrinsically contradictory position. What's also outrageous is that the Anti-Defamation League's Jonathan Greenblatt would claim that Israel is not an apartheid government. What's outrageous is that Jake Tapper would accept Greenblatt's judgment as the truth and not propaganda that needed to be pushed back against. I understand that Greenblatt and perhaps Tapper feel like Israel is not an apartheid state, but unfortunately for them, apartheid isn't about your feelings. It's about facts. In 1973, the UN defined the crime of apartheid as any inhuman acts committed for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination by one racial group of persons over any other racial group of persons and systematically oppressing them. In 1998, the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court defined apartheid as inhumane acts of a character that are committed in the context of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over any other racial group or groups and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. These inhuman acts include, among others, infliction upon the members of a racial group or groups of serious bodily or mental harm by the infringement of their freedom or dignity or by subjecting them to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, by arbitrary arrest and illegal imprisonment of the members of a racial group or groups, any legislative measures and other measures calculated to prevent a racial group or groups from participation in the political, social, economic, and cultural life of the country, and the deliberate creation of conditions preventing the full development of such a group or groups. In particular, by denying to members of a racial group or groups basic human rights and freedoms, including the right to leave and to return to their country, the right to a nationality, the right to freedom of movement and residence, the right to freedom of opinion and expression, and the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association. I'd encourage Jake Tapper to look this up sometime. Here are just a few examples of Israel's apartheid policies. The Law of Return of 1950 allows any Jew, which means anyone with one Jewish grandparent, the right to return to Israel, the right to move to Israel and automatically become citizens of Israel. It gives their spouses that right too, even if they're not Jewish, though if they're Palestinian, that's another issue entirely. Palestinians, of course, lack that right. The Israeli Citizenship Law of 1952 deprived Palestinian refugees and their descendants of legal status, the right to return, and all other rights in their homeland. It also defined Palestinians present in Israel as Israeli citizens without a nationality and group rights. These laws together obviously fit into the International Criminal Court's apartheid criteria. More recently, the nation-state law established that the fulfillment of the right of national self-determination in the state of Israel is unique to the Jewish people. It demoted Arabic from an official language to a language with special status. It also stipulated the state views Jewish settlement as a national value and will labor to encourage and promote its establishment and development. These are just some of the reasons that human rights organizations have declared Israel an apartheid state. Al-Haq, Al-Mezen Center for Human Rights, Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, Adamir, Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, Human Rights Watch, and Amnesty International have all documented Israeli apartheid policies. Israel's own human rights organization, B'Tselem, has declared, "The Israeli regime enacts an apartheid regime." B'Tselem divides the way Israeli apartheid works into four areas. Land. Israel works to Judaize the entire area, treating land as a resource chiefly meant to benefit the Jewish population. Since 1948, Israel has taken over 90% of the land within the Green Line and built hundreds of communities for the Jewish population. Citizenship. Jews living anywhere in the world, their children and grandchildren and their spouses are entitled to Israeli citizenship. In contrast, Palestinians cannot immigrate to Israeli-controlled areas even if they, their parents, or their grandparents were born and lived there. Israel makes it difficult for Palestinians who live in one of the units it controls to obtain status in another and has enacted legislation that prohibits granting Palestinians who marry Israelis status within the Green Line. Freedom of movement. Israeli citizens enjoy freedom of movement in the entire area controlled by Israel and may enter and leave the country freely. Palestinian subjects, on the other hand, require a special Israeli-issued permit to travel between the units and sometimes inside them, and exit abroad also requires Israeli approval. Political participation. Palestinian citizens of Israel may vote and run for office, but leading politicians consistently undermine the legitimacy of Palestinian political representatives. The roughly 5 million Palestinians who live in the occupied territories, including East Jerusalem, cannot participate in the political system that governs their lives and determines their future. I was born in New York City. My great-grandparents and the family before them were from Eastern Europe. I could move to Israel today, buy a house, get a job, travel around with no problem. So could Jake Tapper and Jonathan Greenblatt. But a Palestinian like Rashida Tlaib can't even visit her family home in what is now Israel. This demographic tension is recognized by Israeli officials and politicians who have described their own country as an apartheid state. Former Attorney General Michael Ben-Yair wrote in 2002, We established an apartheid regime in the occupied territories immediately following their capture. That oppressive regime exists to this day. Zahava Galon, former chair of Israel's Meretz party, said in 2006, Israel was relegated to the level of an apartheid state. In 2007, Israel's former education minister, Shulamit Aloni, wrote, "The state of Israel practices its own quite violent form of apartheid with the native Palestinian population." In 2008, former environment minister Yossi Sarid said, "What acts like apartheid, is run like apartheid, and harasses like apartheid is not a duck, it is apartheid." In 2015, former Mossad chief Meir Dagan said, "President Benjamin Netanyahu's policies are leading to either a binational state or an apartheid state." Even Israel's prime ministers have used the A word. In a recently published 1976 interview, assassinated Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said, "If we don't want to get to apartheid, I don't think it's possible to contain over the long term 1.5 million more Arabs inside a Jewish state." In 2007, yet another prime minister, Ehud Olmert, warned, "If the day comes when the two-state solution collapses and we face a South African-style struggle for equal voting rights, then as soon as that happens, the state of Israel is finished." Prime Minister Ehud Barak said in 2010, "As long as in this territory west of the Jordan River, there is only one political entity called Israel, it is going to be either non-Jewish or non-democratic. If this bloc of millions of Palestinians cannot vote, that will be an apartheid state." But there is no other standard more universally respected in defining apartheid, not the UN, not the international criminal courts, not human rights organizations, not Israeli prime ministers, than the people of South Africa who lived under the system of apartheid. After all, apartheid is an Afrikaans word. It means apartness. It was the official policy in South Africa from 1948 to 1994, allowing white South Africans in the minority to rule over and discriminate against the vast majority of black South Africans. The definitions from the United Nations and the International Criminal Court come out of their experiences. In 1997, Nelson Mandela said, "The UN took a strong stand against apartheid, and over the years, an international consensus was built, which helped to bring an end to this iniquitous system. But we know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians." In 2013, Desmond Tutu recalled being struck by the similarities between what he experienced in apartheid South Africa and what he observed in Israel.
"I have visited the occupied Palestinian territories and have witnessed the humiliation of Palestinians at Israeli military checkpoints, the inhumanity that won't let ambulances reach the injured, farmers tend their land, or children attend school. This treatment is familiar to me and the many black South Africans who were corralled and harassed by the security forces of the apartheid government."
Listen to South Africa's Minister for International Relations, Naledi Pandor, addressing the United States General Assembly just last week.
"While we work to address contemporary conflicts, we should not ignore long-standing conflicts, such as that of the people of Palestine, which has been on the United Nations agenda throughout the 7 decades of existence of this organization. We cannot ignore the words of the former Israeli negotiator at the Oslo talks, Daniel Levy, who addressed the UN Security Council recently and referred to the increasingly weighty body of scholarly, legal, and public opinion that has designated Israel to be perpetrating apartheid in the territories under its control."
To my fellow Jews, to my friends in the Democratic Party who want to support Israel and think of themselves as progressive, it is important to look at what Israeli law today does, what the lived experiences of Palestinians today means as defined under international law, and what our friends from South Africa have long pointed out. But we should not stop there. South Africans didn't just define apartheid, they dismantled it. Instead of attacking Rashida Tlaib for her candor, her critics should ask themselves how Israeli apartheid could be dismantled. What would a post-apartheid country look like? Lashana Tova.
That was independent journalist Katie Halper. The commentary you just heard was recorded for The Hill's Rising, which refused to air it and then fired Halper. The Hill is owned by Nexstar Media Group.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for the answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for the answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine.
While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse at the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly, and we're automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family. Palestine remains in my heart forever. We stand for peace, times of war, we shan't surrender. Remember, it didn't start in this dark December. Every coin is a bullet if your marks and Spencer.
Long Live Palestine by Loki. You're listening to COVID, Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Last week, thousands of United Airlines flight attendants protested union busting by the company. They rallied throughout the U.S. and airports around the world. At San Francisco International Airport, they joined 1,000 striking local food service workers who were fighting for living wages. Their strike was settled after they forced the restaurants to close down for 3 days.
I said, no, the flight attendants are energizing me. We were on the front lines fighting for payroll support. Yeah. They got the money to support this airline on our backs.
Yeah. My name is Molly Gomez, and I'm with Unite here. We're also having our strike, but these people are flight attendants. They're our brothers and sisters, and we're out here supporting them.
You went on strike yesterday?
We went on strike yesterday.
What are the issues?
Healthcare, wages, and pension. That's it.
The prices are going up on the food here for the patrons.
Have gone up. The employers are making money again, but we are not. Haven't had a raise since 2018.
How do you survive?
Friends, family, and I'm a frugal person. Our union has a food bank. We got, you know, the union tries to help us as we can. But yeah, it's been really a tough time. The pandemic was bad enough, but coming back and being disrespected is awful. It's unbelievable. They took government money, you know, paycheck protection, all this stuff, and they're not passing it on. It's totally unfair. They're being greedy.
These businesses are raising the prices. They're making money now.
They did, yes. Absolutely. 100%.
$16 for a sandwich?
A hamburger's $19.95 where I work, and I make $15.10.
So the sandwich is $19.95, or a hamburger is $19.95, and you make?
$15.10.
After they take out taxes,
what do you get? Forget it. And parking. We have to pay for parking, too.
Survival. I mean,
survival. Survival. A lot of my coworkers have 2 and 3 jobs, and they sleep in their cars just to come to work. I'm lucky. I live close by, and I'm not in that situation. But a lot of my coworkers are really hurting. It's a bad situation.
My name is Christy Rivera. I'm the local president for San Francisco AFA, who represents United Airlines flight attendants.
It seems like a lot of your members are fed up and angry here today.
Yeah. we've been fed up and for quite some time. We've been fed up since May, and that's about the time our passengers started seeing cancellations and delays. So we need United Airlines to fix the operational issues that they have not only with our customers, but also internally. Our scheduling, we have to wait 4, 5, 6 hours sometimes to find out where we might be sleeping tonight. It's not just stress, it's also rest. I mean, we're a safety-sensitive job. We are aviation's first responders, and as flight attendants, we have to have rest in order to operate our aircraft the next day, and that in turn delays flights again for the following day. And this is simply because United Airlines doesn't have enough staffing in their scheduling department internally. So early in the spring, United is all about forecasting. They knew numbers were going to be coming back and coming back swift after COVID. People are ready to travel and to be out in the world again, traveling. So we knew flights were going to be packed. We knew that they were increasing flights. While we have plenty of flight attendants to staff these aircraft, what we don't have are schedulers. Schedulers, we generally had pre-COVID about 175. I believe now we're down to about 70.
There's an organizing drive at Delta flight attendants. I mean, it seems like workers around the country are looking to unions to say we need some rights on the job.
I think the labor movement in general has really kind of taken off, and for good reason. When one worker can't get something done with their management, they feel powerless. But when you're out here in an action like today, you realize that
you have the power.
We do. We have the ability to stand together side by side, know that I've got your back, you've got mine, and we can get things done collectively.
My name is Ken Diaz. I'm the Master Executive Council President representing the 25,000 flight attendants at United Airlines.
They get a lot of money from the federal government.
That's the thing. We were out in the front lines and got them the help and the money they needed to get through the pandemic. And once that was gone, they dropped us. They got what they needed. No one in this country can say our passengers were treated with dignity and respect this past summer of what they had to go through with the cancellations, the delays, the waiting for answers. And we're trying to say internally we're going through that. And if they had the schedulers in place to react, a good airline can operate in good weather. A great airline knows to operate under irregular operations.
Today's rally, also the service workers, food service workers are here. The Teamsters are here.
We stand in solidarity with them. We stand in solidarity with them because some of these food service workers are making $16, $17 an hour and can't care for their families.
My name is Maureen Azair, and I'm working at the hotel at San Francisco, but now I'm here to support those workers at the airport, the restaurant, the flight attendant. So we are here, damn right, to fight, and we're going to win. Even though we take longer, but we know we're going to succeed. We're going to win.
And the service workers here can't live. They have to have two or three jobs. What are the conditions here for workers?
Because the employees, they don't pay the employers enough. The employer doesn't pay the employers enough money for them to survive. So they have no other choice but to have three jobs to support their family. It is unacceptable. The airports, we are running it. We are workers. We demand for the owners to give us our share of fare. This is the reason why we are here today, to fight. That's why we are here, to fight. That's why we are here, to fight. Damn right, we're going to win the fight.
My name is Jesus.
How long have you worked here at the airport?
I've been here for 15 years, sir.
It's getting worse with the inflation?
Exactly. It's been getting worse because, as you know, housing here in San Francisco is too high. It's crazy. Actually, a lot of co-workers, they've been moving to Sacramento, to Modesto, Stockton, because over there is really cheap, cheaper than here. Here is really difficult to survive with the salary that we are getting now. That's why most of the people is doing two jobs and a full time and a part time. Imagine that.
Carolina Arroyo. I am a bartender at United Lounge at United.
Does United run it or it's contracted out?
Contract lounge. We are what do you call this? Subcontract.
Subcontracts.
Yeah.
So have they increased wages with inflation?
No, that's why we're here for our future.
You know,
I'm start working there since 1998.
Long time.
A long time, yeah. But when people asking me, how long you work on that company? I said, more than 25 years. How long you're receiving? Oh, something like this, under minimum. So, what? How do you feel about that, you know?
To survive under minimum wage.
Yeah, you have to work before. I'm working two jobs to survive. My, what do you call this, my mortgage.
All my bills. Bills are going up.
Yeah. Last week, I just half tank of my gasoline is $80, and my salary is under minimum. How could you survive that?
That's why you're out here today.
Yeah, that's why we are here, for our future and another generation future.
Those were striking food service workers and United Airlines flight attendants protesting union busting at San Francisco International Airport.
Man, I'm broken in the old VCR, man. I need a job. Are they hiring at your job? I got a stack of red bills at my house, man. Look like Valentine's Day at the crib. My kids eating leftovers, man. I can't fool them no more. It's job time. My God, it's gotta be more to life than this. It's gotta be a bigger reason that I exist. Work to eat, to earn my keep, and ensure somewhere to sleep and spend the weekend buying shit. Don't need economists to know I need a pot to piss. Follow politics, man, I ain't got no time to think. What I got to set aside for my retirement? Cop a double shift, pay somebody to watch the kids. Sick of all this, but can't take an off day. Doctor's office, I can't swing the copay. Trapped in a network, lucky just to get work. They celebrate every week, nobody gets hurt. Greed can never leave well enough alone. They keep on squeezing till we bleed from every bone. And we'll strive hard and stress about the rent. Probably still die poor and in debt without a cent. But I guess I'll carry my ass down to the county, see what they talking about. But you know they treat you like a shot.
That was Brother Ali, Work Every Day. Dallas Black Dance Theater proudly presents its 17th annual Dance Africa, October the 7th and 8th, 2022, at the Moody Performance Hall and the Dance Africa Festival and Marketplace at Clyde Warren Park, October 8, 2022, in Dallas. Nicole Ray of Dallas Black Dance Theater elaborates.
Baba Chuck Davis, who started Dance Africa in New York at BAM, I believe it's been over 50 years since the programming began. And Baba Chuck wanted it to be further reaching out into the communities throughout the United States. So then there were different companies in different states that started to produce their own Dance Africa. And we happened to be one of them. And we are now celebrating 17 years of producing Dance Africa. My involvement to become like the producer of it came after Baba Chuck's passing. When he would come down and be with us, I was pretty much like his right hand and made sure that he had everything that he needed and just sort of helped him to direct everything. Upon his passing, it sort of transferred over to me, and I take it with great honor to keep his legacy going. Also for Dance Africa. So now celebrating my 25th year with Dallas Black Dance Theater, going on now about 5 years of producing Dance Africa. I love the task. I love the community involvement that it takes to put it on. So it's a production that we are definitely really proud of.
And this year's festival features performances by, tell us, Nicole.
Oh my goodness. So that's so exciting. This festival gives opportunity for local groups to perform. I mean, all types of performances, church groups, high schools, just smaller dance companies. It's just fantastic. Fashion shows, like it's some of everything. It's so exciting. And our guest artist this year for Dance Africa is Giwayen Mata out of Atlanta. And This group of all sisters is amazing. They will be performing for the festival as well as Dallas Black Dance Theater, DBDT Encore, our youth companies. We're having vendors with all different types of wares. And we have a crafting area for our kiddos when they come on through. And so it's just really full of energy and exciting. We started with a parade, drumming up the energy and letting people know that, hey, we're here. Come on down to this park and see what's happening. It's a wonderful experience.
I'm reading here the prestigious Booker T. Washington High School for the Performing Arts Visual Dance Conservatory. I think you mentioned the acronym. Will present fierce movement and dedication to the female elders of the community. The yes. institution located in the heart of Dallas Arts District has received over 400 awards through the National Young Arts Foundation and produced 25 presidential scholars in the arts. Mm-hmm. How amazing is that?
It's fantastic. We're so blessed to have them right next door to us. And so that energy of their students who some come and take classes at our academy as well. We really like to keep it in the community and in the family. Yes, they will be performing for our evening shows for Dance Africa, and we're so delighted that they are back with us. They haven't been able to perform for us these last few years.
Talk to us about the founder, Ann Williams.
The Ann Williams. She founded Dallas Black Dance Theater in 1976. So we are celebrating 46 years strong. So excited. Miss Williams, who started the company very small, and it has grown into this magnificent institution, and especially under the direction of our now artistic director, Melissa M. Young, who is taking the company in different heights. Ms. Williams is so proud of the direction in which the company is going.
You guys are now located downtown Dallas.
That is correct. We are in the beginning of the Arts District. So we're one of the resident companies here for the AT&T Performing Arts Center. So yes, and we are in the historic Moreland YMCA, which is where Miss Williams took class as a child. And also when she got older, she taught class in this building. And so her vision of wanting to purchase the building, keeping it in the African-American community, was such an important goal of hers. And when we were able to attain the building, I mean, we were elated and so excited. And I encourage everyone to come on down and see where we are. It's a wonderful building. I think we've done a magnificent job in restoring it and keeping its history on the inside and the out. So please come down and visit us. We'd love to see people here.
That was Nicole Ray, producer of Dance Africa. The Dallas Black Dance Theater was founded in 1976 by Ann Williams. Its mission is to create and produce contemporary modern dance at the highest level of artistic excellence. As the largest and oldest professional dance company in Dallas, Dallas Black Dance Theater is the fourth largest black dance company in the nation and the ninth largest contemporary modern dance company. Dance Africa will be featured in Dallas on October 7th and 8th, 2022 at 7:30 p.m. at Moody Performance Hall. You can live stream the event or watch it on demand. To find out more about Dance Africa, visit www.dbdt.com. That's www.dbdt.com or call 214-880-0202. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer, with assistance from Pacifica's Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.